Hey everybody, welcome back to Adventures on Infant Island, the pop culture podcast that pits two monster properties against one another in a knockdown, drag-out chat. I'm Mike Olivares, and joined once again by the ever-wonderful Jenny Park. Hey Jenny, how's it going?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks.
How's this week been? Right now, it's disgusting out there.
It's pretty hot, yeah.
Yeah, and on top of it, you know, we live in a really small environment that doesn't have much ventilation, so as of right now, we are, you know, probably losing weight as we speak, which is probably a really good thing. But what else has been going on this week?
As for me, just working and watching a lot of movies, and I'm happy about that,
Okay, well, you know, one of the big things that we probably won't be able to discuss right away is what we watched just last night. We finally caved in at the last... Well, we were going to see it this weekend anyway, but we had no idea we were going to be able to check it out quite so fast. We finally caught Chris Nolan's Inception, which we won't be able to discuss on this podcast, but all I'll have to say is to check out my review on wanderingkaiju.blogspot.com. I just posted it this morning. It's a pretty amazing piece of work. Some really quick words there, Jenny. What did you think?
I thought it was like a very awesome experience, and I got an awesome brain workout. I never got that much brain workout by watching a movie before, and even after it was over, my brain was like still like, you know, in that mode of thinking, you know. It's just great. I feel like my brain has been to the gym, and I think we need that.
Yeah, it's an incredible experience. For those who are still on the fence about watching that film, by all means, if you want to be challenged by cinema, by all means, run, don't walk to the theater to check it out. And besides, you got much greater air conditioning than like the air conditioning that is in our homes right now. Anyway, speaking of the summer heat, you know, that's a great way and a great segue for us to go into thinking cool. So we're going to think cool thoughts. We're going to think cool, nice, cool place you can get away for not quite so much money and spend a really good time, invested in some amazing work. Of course, the person who we speak of is probably the inventor of this. He's a household name. What else can be possibly said about Mr. Spielberg? Especially when you consider the fact that his films pretty much helped define the summer movie for over 35 years now, and is still going strong. But what's been really, really cool is being able to show a lot of the earliest works from Mr. Spielberg to Jenny, and gave her a crash course, as it were, over the summer. And for instance, which films did we watch over this summer that you hadn't seen before of older Spielberg?
Well, I remember seeing Jaws when I was a kid because you know people were just watching it on cable or on, you know, VHS, DVD, whatever have you. But I wasn't really familiar with it because I wasn't sitting there actually watching the movie. But this time around, I actually paid attention to the movie, and now I'm familiar with the story itself and the characters and everything. And I'm glad. And I feel like, you know, Mike here is like my film 101 professor, because it's like a crash course. Seriously, it's a crash course. And I'm glad that I'm watching all these movies. These are like golden jewels to me now.
I just actually had to throw that in. What else did I show you that was also from the early days that is important to this discussion?
Well, not only Jaws, but Duel was really great, and I really like the Indiana Jones series, or trilogy rather. I really love that. Raiders of the Ark, Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, all those movies.
So let's go back to the first two that we discussed there. We mentioned were Duel and Jaws. Those are two early exercises in young Spielberg's career, where he was pitting the ordinary man against forces of nature, or in the case of Duel, a force Well, it could be very well a force of nature, since it really is just a man driving along a lonely desert road being marauded by a mysterious truck driver who has it in for him.
I was frightened watching the duel because you're in the middle of nowhere, and there's a car or a truck chasing you, but you don't even know what the man looks like. This mystery man, you know, person in the truck driving and chasing after you throughout your whole road trip, and you don't even see this person. So, of course, it's going to scare you. If you get to see that person's face, you know, at least you'll have something to work with, but you can't even see his face. So that frightened the heck out of me.
Well, what blows me away most is the fact that it was a TV movie and starring Dennis Weaver, and it's not even just the fact that you can't see his face. It's the fact that he's done nothing for this. There's no reason at all. There's no rhyme, there's nothing that our ordinary man has done to deserve this treatment, which is to be tormented along a long stretch of road on this long drive, and it's just, that's all it is. The entire film, most of the movie is practically no dialogue whatsoever, maybe a little bit of internal dialogue from Mr. Weaver suffering from, you know, panic and paranoia, but other than that, the film is really just a big 90-minute chase.
So what kind of effects did you have as a child watching this?
Oh, man.
Did it scare you, scare you out of your pants to a point where you don't want to go in the middle of nowhere with anybody even?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. I mean, I caught Duel a little bit later, you know, because Duel came out in the very, very early 70s, like pre-Jaws. This was the work that got Spielberg the respect to start actually doing feature films. But I saw Jaws first.
Oh, okay.
See, yeah, when I was a very young kid, I was taken to see Jaws in the theater, you know, and that scared the bejeebus out of not only all the kids, but all the adults. And, you know, it's one of those moments where you just never forget it. And even through those years, I caught other Spielberg movies. I caught Close Encounters in the theater, both the regular and special edition, into 1980. Mm. And it wasn't until 1982, I think, that they showed Duel on TV on Channel 13, LA, KCOP. And it just knocked me on my ass. Me and my mom were just sitting there, just with our eyes like saucers, just staring at the TV like, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah.
Just pulling for this poor guy, because we don't know what the hell that is. We just know it's death. That's it.
Well, I was rooting for the guy. I wanted him to make it. You know, and he did make it, although he didn't have his car anymore, but...
Oh, we need to throw that in there, ladies and gentlemen, is that after the movie was over, it was kind of clear to me after the film was over, and, you know, spoilers for the end of Duel, Dennis Weaver does survive the ordeal, and the truck is more or less vanquished. We don't know much about the fate about the truck driver that's been chasing him at all. We don't know. All we know is he sacrificed his car in order to stop him. And so he's just sitting out there in the middle of this vast desert with no vehicles around. And I could look over to Jenny, and Jenny has this look on her face like, but he has no car.
Yeah, I'm like, who's going to rescue him? You know, how is he going to get home? Is he going to walk? Is he going to, you know, pick up a ride? You know,
it's 1971, 72. There's no cell phone and there's no payphone. I think that kind of gave her a little bit of a panic attack.
Yeah, I was sort of scared. I mean, I was thinking, if I were in his shoes, what would I do? Seriously.
Well, what would you have done then?
I would have walked until I see the nearest town and see the payphone, and as soon as I see that sucker, just call.
But you have no dimes.
Well, I'll like wash somebody's car and, you know, and get some change. I don't know. I want to get home and see my wife and my kids.
Oh, it's simpler times. But okay, that leads perfectly into Jaws, which, you know, you mentioned before that you've grown up with it kind of around you, but you never really watched it. But finally getting a chance to sit down and experience this milestone of a film, like, what are your feelings on that
one? Well, before I get into that, the first time I ever watched it was back in like 1989. I was like 5 years old, and then I was watching it with my family, and I just, you know, had a little panic attack. I was scared, but I really didn't know anything about the actual story or, you know, any of the characters, but I just was scared for seeing the scary shark, and that's about it. Simple as that. Mm. But now, you know, it's more complex than that. I actually, you know, have opinions about, you know, the movie itself because I really know what's going on, you know.
Okay, well, what kind of feelings are those? Like, what do you feel about it?
Well, about the rich people, like, you know, that one guy that was running the island, you know.
Oh, the mayor.
Mayor. I thought he was a bit of a jerk, and he didn't care about people's safety, and, you know, he was just a sick opportunist, that's all, you know. Mm. And I just see all these things going on behind the scenes, and, you know, if these, you know, people that are high up there don't think about the outcomes, you know, people are going to get hurt. And I felt bad for the people that were visiting the island just to have fun, but instead they're like getting killed and being eaten by the shark because of this greedy jerk. Yeah. I can't think of the right word to describe the man.
Well, I mean, that plays perfectly into the fact that a lot of Spielberg's movies always deal with the common man going up against these forces, you know, that are just naive about nature. They don't seem to understand the how nature is kind of indifferent to other forms of life that are around, and that, you know, if it's threatened for any reason, they'll fight back, or they'll just eat anything that goes into their way. Mm. Which is great that you have a character to connect with, or characters to connect with, like Sheriff Brody.
I don't know why
Roy Scheider.
Yeah. My favorite was Hooper. Sorry to cut you off, but that's my favorite.
Richard?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Hooper by Richard Dreyfuss. That's an awesome character. That's like the quintessential college, you know, marine biologist expert kind of. You know, you can totally tell he was also very much an activist of the late 60s. You know, just very, 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 you know, punchy when it comes to, being put up against the wall. Because, you know, since he's such a nerdy guy, he has his mouth and his intelligence to fight back. Which is perfect for him once him and Brody meet up with their fisherman that is going to help them catch the shark or stop it, which is Robert Shaw's character, Quint, who's basically like, you know, the Captain Ahab of the story, the old-fashioned man who's out to, you know, settle a score of some sort.
But then the thing with Jaws is, like, it can be related to any generation, even now. You know, you remember the golf spill not too long ago? When rich opportunists just think about their wealth and nothing else, then, you know, we're going to have to deal with these things. It's not just for that period of time. It's also relevant to now as well. That's what I think.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of a lot of great stories, particularly a lot of the ones that Spielberg has always touched on, is these are just universal things that keep coming and they keep happening generation after generation. It never goes old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's nothing more relevant to the fact that we don't understand nature, let alone understand nature under the water.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a shark in waters like that, you know, it's going to do what it wants. Yeah. It's not evil. It's not a villain.
Yeah.
It's just hungry. You happen to be in the way. That's it. You know. I mean, do we care about like picking fruit off of a tree? Not really. What if the fruit can scream? Would you still eat it? Think about that. So I mean, in the end, I mean, Spielberg has always been a master at ramping up suspense in an almost Hitchcockian sense.
And also his movies I don't know what it is. It's ahead of its time, first of all. Second of all, it doesn't feel dated even after you watch it like 20 years later or whatever, 30 years later.
Yeah, there's a certain timelessness about a lot of his works that they never feel
old. It's timeless and universal. I think he's a master at that, in my opinion.
You know, which is great, because after Jaws, he kind of became Mr. Spectacle for a long time. He became, a producer. He also directed a few movies in hopes of getting an Oscar grab. Of course, he went on to do E.T. He produced Poltergeist for Tobe Hooper. And he did a lot of other, you know, franchises, of course. We also mentioned the Indiana Jones films. So he had a huge bout of success, but it was very commercial. And it wasn't until the 90s where he finally received this sort of respect of, like, the Oscars by doing Schindler's List, which kind of was a turning point in his career because he was kind of going away from just the popular entertainment kind of movie, you know. So when he did Schindler's List, everyone was thinking, oh, he's going to be a serious director now. Mm-hmm. But little did we know that, you know, a little movie was going to come out in 93 that was going to bring him back with a populist vengeance. Now, I need to go ahead and preface this, Jenny, because before we get to the focus of this little discussion, I want to mention that back in around high school, right around 1991, 92, I was in drama club, and I had a lot of good buddies who were super nerdy, and this is still, you know, this is when, like, the internet was one of those things that, you know, maybe one kid out of, you know, your entire class might have had something resembling the internet, you know, when it was still called the well, and, they, you know, there was little, it was just sending email, and it was a very slow email machine at that. Anyway, the word was out that there was a really, really cool book by a famous author whom I'd known of as being the guy who wrote Andromeda Strain. That's a guy named Michael Crichton. He cranked out a new book called Jurassic Park, and I heard that it had to do with a tycoon who has basically cracked the genetic code for bringing dinosaurs back to our age and looking to create a theme park on this and invite some scientists and a lawyer and a mathematician to approve it. Anyway, I heard some really cool word about the book, and I also saw how big it was. This book was impressive for me back in 1992, because I only read, you know, novels that were like pushing, you know, I don't know, 200, 300 pages. I was kind of a lightweight at first, at that point, but I was blown away. When you open the book, what's crazy about the book is you don't, it's just, it doesn't have just text. It has charts. Wow. It has graphs. In other words, Crichton did all this research to make it real. There's actually like graphics and things inside based on like some of the characters' findings. And there's a lot of research that was made, biological research. And also there's a mathematical thing that the character of Ian Malcolm, who we'll discuss mm-hmm. later, he comes up with a theory as to how it would look like when the dinosaurs basically turn against man in this park. Anyway, the talk was by about 92 that Steven Spielberg, of all people, was going to direct the movie version of this. So everyone was like, oh my God, that's going to be awesome. And this was right around that point when he was about, you know, Schindler's List was about, you know, about to come out. And we were like, but he's Mr. Serious. How can he go back to doing dinosaurs? And how are we going to do dinosaurs? How is this possible? Well, the only thing that we had to work with, Jen, was because around that time, the only movie that was doing this new type of special effects that would allow dinosaurs to happen was Mr. James wow. Cameron, who had just done Terminator 2 with, you know, the T-1000. You see, that was unheard of. Back then, we didn't have anything like that. So when we saw the T-1000 and Dennis Muren's visual effects, we were like, oh my God, that means you can almost do anything now. But we didn't see it. We could only just imagine it. We had no visual proof to see the limits of the technology. So we were like, man, whatever these dinosaurs are going to look like, they're going to probably look pretty cool. But at the same time, we as kids in the early 90s, the height of graphics that we saw when we were kids was like Super Nintendo. That was as good as it got, you know? We couldn't imagine anything more awesome than that. We were pretty limited in our vision, and we didn't see any like great examples except for Abyss and Terminator 2. So in 93, when Jurassic Park was about to come out, and the trailers only hinted at what we were going to see, which we saw some beautiful puppets and a couple of shots, like amazing shots of dinosaurs. We're like, how can this be real? How can this be possible? But I didn't feel it until the day we saw it in the theater. When we sat down, and here's the cool part. This movie came out the day after I graduated.
Wow.
Graduation
present
forget
for
it.
You.
Yeah, it was okay. Check it out. Here's the deal. Me and our old friend, mutual friend of ours who lives in town, she and I used to write reviews for the Desert Sun newspaper for the, you know, youth
wow.
section, you know. Yeah, they were trying to, you know, get kids to write newspaper articles, and our job was to do movie reviews. Anyway, we were invited by the newspaper, along with a geologist and several other scientists, to watch the film on the first day mm-hmm. and do a review of it on camera for the local yeah. TV station. And sure enough, we sat in that theater before the kids, you know, got out of summer mm-hmm. school or what have you. And we saw it. And the first time we saw the Brachiosaurus, when they first arrive on the island, and the first time that, you know, Alan Grant and Ellie Sattler, the scientists, first time they see a dinosaur, it's one of those moments, Jen, I can't describe it to you, because, again, there was no reference in our brains for that at the time. We had no concept of how you know how this was going to be possible. And so when we saw that Brachiosaurus just sort of walk over and eat a little off the tree, you just felt your heart kind of soar. And of course you got the John Williams music, and you felt a lump in your throat of, my God, this is just the beginning of the movie, and I'm already kind of feeling it, like, oh my God, this is special. And of course, you know, the rest of the movie is really just nothing more than a fun ride, but it was that moment, and then the T-Rex scene around almost an hour into the film, and it was that kind of thing where you knew at that moment that the world was wide open in regards to movies. You could do anything. That said, I stayed that day, and I saw it again with other friends. Everybody from the Desert Sun left. Even our friend left. Other friends came, and I stayed with them and watched it again. And then I stepped out of the theater, and other friends came in, and I went in and watched it with them again. So it was a pretty big deal back when it was brand new, and it's still, you know, it's still a very fond movie in the memories of a lot of younger people who are, you know, children, you know, who are born in the 80s. So, I mean, what's your history? I'm really curious about your history with Jurassic
Park.
Well,
speaking of which, when Jurassic Park first came out, which was year 1993, am I right? Yep. I was like 8 or 9. You know, I was still in elementary school, and then I went with my cousins again, and I just, you know, watched it. Back then, I was just like in awe of the dinosaurs, and nothing else clicked, because, you know, I was still a child, and I just liked the visuals, you know. But now, you know, it's a little bit different. You know, there's more character, more story, other than just looking at the dinosaurs and go, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
So now, as an adult, you know, I can, you know, have this emotion while watching it, unlike before. Before, I was just in awe of it, because think about it. You're in elementary school and you see a dinosaur. You just can't help but to go, whoa, I won't be able to see this ever. Only in a movie, you know? But now,
right,
it's like emotional. You know, I get to actually know the characters, and I really love the Ellie. Ellie's one of my favorites.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ellie Sattler, played by Laura Dern,
is
great. Yeah. You know, it's one of those movies where, you know, when the film first came out, the critics kind of said, you know, well, the characters are pretty flat, and, you know, they don't have a lot to do in regards to character arc or story changes. But in retrospect, you know what? I mean, even Jaws was kind of, well, I don't know. There was a little more. Actually, I would have to argue still that Brody actually had more character to him. But I will still say this. At least we had the essence of these scientist characters, because we had their concerns.
I think the most important thing is believability. It doesn't seem phony at all, because these people come off as real scientists and real people. So I feel like what they're doing, what they're saying, seem convincing and believable, you know? They don't just look like these, you know, awesome, like, Hollywood scientists that feel phony, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I like the idea that, even it's like this in the book, too, is the idea that Dr. Ellie Sattler and Sam Neill's character, Alan Grant, are implied to be, you know, a couple who had been spending all this time, you know, digging up velociraptor bones over in Montana, and they get summoned, you know, with the hope of getting some grant money to continue their research by checking out this, you know, John Hammond's, this rich tycoon's big old, you know, playpen, so to speak, filled with dinosaurs in modern day. So right away, it's the discovery. The whole first part of the movie is all about, you know, them seeing it just like we're seeing it, the discovery of this miracle. But then, of course, the fact that it's a theme park, and that this is a totally different ecosystem that we're dealing with here. You can't really control, you know, millions of years of instinct in order to have paying customers, you know, ride through and watch it like a San Diego Zoo.
My favorite scene was the kitchen scene with Lex and Timmy. I don't know about you, but I really like that scene.
the velociraptors.
Yeah, velociraptors. Well, you know, they were really scary and overwhelming, and these two little kids were trying to, you know, sneak their way out of it, and I was like cheering for them. I just couldn't help it. I'm like, go, you guys can get out of there, you know. And they're pretty brilliant. They were able to, you know, get out of there.
But setting it up is, you know, that's an important part. And in the book, you know, of course, you get a lot more time to get to know who these people are. And, you know, a movie, you only have so much time to do it. In regards to this, yes, they are kind of flat. And it's true, they don't really get a lot of depth. And they don't really get a lot of, you know, time in edgewise for, you know, interaction. But I can still feel like, you know, we got something. You know, it's a ride that actually is human, just human enough to enjoy. But, yeah, I mean, as far as, okay, going back to what we were talking about here about favorite scenes, I suppose we can just go ahead and segue into that. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's still, for me, the first hour of the film that's strong. I don't really feel like the second hour meets up to it at all. I think the second half actually kind of runs out of gas. But I still feel like the whole first hour up until the T-Rex paddock sequence is where the movie is at its strongest. Because, you know, but before that point, we don't know what to expect from the island. We don't know what we're going to see, what dinosaurs we're going to see, what we're not going to see, and how they were going to do it. And you got to remember, back then, CG wasn't doing everything. One thing that was really super awesome about the movie's effects was that it was the perfect marriage between Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett doing the CG effects. But it wasn't all CG. There was also huge puppets, articulated stuff, and handmade stuff by Stan Winston's studio. You know, Stan Winston, who worked for Cameron all these years. He did all these, like, puppets. So what they did is it was the perfect mixture between practical effects and digital effects. And that mixture, cutting them together, you'd hardly notice. You hardly can't tell which ones are the CG and which ones are not. And even the ones that are puppets are so realistic, you're completely into it. That T-Rex is just awesome, even now.
Yeah, they seem real to me.
Yeah, even now I still buy it. You're watching it on a little wonky little DVD on a TV set, and I'm like, shit, yeah, I still buy it every bit as much as I did back in 93 in a big movie theater. It has not changed any for me in that regard. Second half, you know, again, it's not bad. It's just it feels kind of like they're looking really hard for a way to end it on a different note, because the book itself actually ends on kind of a downer. It's very different. John Hammond does not survive. Just out of that end. Also, Ian Malcolm, we don't know if he survives, actually. He's left. Mm-hmm. He's kind of sort of left for dead. They blow up the island, and then Alan Grant asks Muldoon. Muldoon survives, okay? That's the weird part. And he looks over at Muldoon, and he goes, Malcolm? And then Muldoon just looks at him, like, shaking his head, like. And I'm like, oh, my God. So, technically, that's the second Lost World novel. It's not about Malcolm at all. So, it's totally different. That granted, there were some things in the book that there was no way in 1992, 93 they could have made. There was some special.
Wow.
There's some stuff in there when you read it, you're like, oh, that would have been awesome if they could have made it, but there's no way.
But now they could probably pull it off since they have CG and everything. So.
No, Jenny, that's what I was going to tell you. You know, reason why we're talking about this Jurassic Park right now, ladies and gentlemen, is because after many months of deliberating, we finally purchased the Jurassic Park Adventure Pack, which is the 3-disc set containing 1, 2, and 3. We've only rewatched 1 and 2 over the course of this last week. Now, we haven't watched 3 yet. And I've already seen it. I saw it back when it was new, and I've already warned Jenny about the third film. But what I'm going to say here is it's nice that you brought up the idea of, like, now we can make those scenes. Well, I'll tell you this right now. More or less, they do make the scene. They actually do it in part 3. The scene that they couldn't do before, they put it in there, but it doesn't help the movie at all. You know what? We're just going to have to come back and discuss part 3 maybe in another episode just to see your impressions. But as far as, like, Jurassic Park, though, yeah, that I will agree, as far as action scenes, that kitchen scene is really good, because the velociraptors have always been great.
Yeah, I mean, the velociraptors really scare the living crap out of me.
Yeah, those.
While watching it, I'm like, I couldn't help but to root for those kids, because, I mean, if I were in that situation, I don't think I would have been able to, like, survive, because you have to be really quick, witty, and smart to get out of that situation. Yeah. Those things are scary.
Yeah, they're pack hunters, which makes matters worse. You know, you're not just dealing with one, and they're far from stupid. They're
quick and smart for a big creature.
Yeah, they apparently their brain is roughly the size of a human's. So they have problem-solving capability, at least according to theory. And, around that time, the Velociraptors were relatively new on the chart. Like, they'd only just found the fossil for them, like, not too long before the book was made. And so, at the time, they were like, everybody always used to think that the T-Rex was, like, the biggest bad boy on the block as far as predators were concerned. But when they discovered the Velociraptors, they were like, no. These guys were badass.
This makes me want to actually read the book, you know.
It's worth it.
I want to, be able to compare and see how accurate the movies are compared to the book.
Yeah, and I also think that, when we were talking about this, I think the other thing is, for you, is it's or at least maybe, on my opinion, maybe I'm just guessing, I could be wrong, is the fact that Spielberg has a tendency to kind of put kids in these films, and they're in the book too, but I think that seems like that's something that seemed to connect to you quite a bit, and I think that that helped connect with a lot of younger kids who watched the movie back when it was new too.
Yeah, I don't understand why, but even till this day, back then, definitely, because I was a kid, but now I'm a grown adult, I'm 25 years old, and I still feel like, I need to see kids, so I don't know. I don't think I've really grown up that much.
So, okay, with that said, Jurassic Park is still a pretty, awesome, exciting piece of work that's good to watch every once in a while. A good, I wouldn't say time killer. It's definitely a product of its time. It's a nice combination between Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Me also want to do the whole safari thing.
What do you mean by that?
Like, wear the little outfit that Ellie was wearing and just go camping and be with nature.
Okay, well, the safari would involve hunting.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to kill animals.
Okay.
Because I love them so much.
Okay. With that said, though, we need to go ahead and continue the discussion about the pack we've just been talking about. And in the tradition of Adventures on Infinite Island, we need to go ahead and bring up perhaps an opposing film, something to go up against it. And because the format is still forming, we can go ahead and go right into 1997's The Lost World Jurassic Park, which, no doubt was made because the money was huge for the first movie. And at least according to Spielberg at the time, it was to popular demand that he felt like he needed to go back, this time to Isla Sorna, to, show that there were more dinosaurs that apparently survived that are, like, living wildly and not in a park environment. They're basically out in the wild, and this story now involves Hammond disclosing the secret of this island while company interests that have turned their back on him are now, wanting to use this opportunity to have dinosaurs to save, his company, InGen.
Yeah.
And, of course, in for the ride is going to be one of the survivors of the first film, which was, Jeff Goldblum's Dr. Ian Malcolm, the chaotician, probably my favorite character from the first movie, to have him come back in the second film to go and try and save his girlfriend, played by Julianne Moore, alongside, Vince Vaughn, a young Vince Vaughn. And it's a strange sequel because you don't have, all the original characters. All you really have is Jeff Goldblum and a bunch of bulked up CG effects dinosaurs that look nicer than before.
I gotta interrupt you there. I like the CG effect, but my problem was the believability. It seemed like Hollywood. Like what I was telling you about the first one, it actually felt like I can believe that world. I feel like these people, Ellie and Alan are these archaeologists, scientists, going over to like certain places to do a study, but with the Lost World I felt like it was too Hollywoody.
Like, what do you mean? I don't understand what that means.
Like, for instance, Sarah, Ian's girlfriend, she seemed too much like a scientist.
Well, she is.
Yeah, I mean, like, she doesn't really have warmth like Ellie did, and that's what I liked about Ellie, but Sarah didn't really have that. She didn't seem like a real, like, woman.
Well, and you know what? You know, we need to backpedal a little bit, and that's the problem. The film ultimately is so obsessed with just getting to it that it never, ever finds its footing in regards to characters. We could care less about the characters, and it's really just bring on the dinosaurs time.
Yeah, there was no build-up, really.
Yeah.
It was just happening.
Yeah, there's nothing to hold on to in the second film. As much as it tries to, you know, ramp up the effects and the action scenes, none of it really sort of, you know, has any sort of gravitas or any, you know, you have nobody to hold on to, so therefore it's hard for us to care. I don't know. I don't know about your feeling on that. I mean, even though they did bring another kid, I don't know.
It wasn't the same as Lex and Timmy.
Yeah.
It didn't do the job. I think they were honestly trying, but it didn't work on me.
Yeah, I think this time, yeah, it was only David Kep this time who wrote it, and there was just something really missing about that second movie.
That girl, Kelly, the young girl, she, you know, just felt a little bit annoying to me. But I don't know. I mean, it seemed like they were trying, but not enough.
You know, the other thing, too, is it was 1997, and it was a very, dare I say this, I would say that the late 90s was a very, I don't know, a very trying time for Hollywood. I think the trend at the time was a lot of sarcasm and a lot of very, very kind of mean sarcasm at that. Mm-hmm. A lot of it just felt very kind of just pent up and angry. And there's just something about The Lost World that, you know, for a movie that should, you know, be fun, it isn't a lot of fun. And now that I've watched it after so many years, because honestly, I have not seen it since I saw it in the theater back then, I've noticed now that the film's theme seems to be about, you know, childhood abandonment. And it doesn't seem to be something that really works with Jurassic Park. Or even if it did, it never gives us any reason to really care about the situation. Because we got the parallel. We got Jeff Goldblum, or Ian Malcolm's character, his character of Ian Malcolm, reunited with his estranged daughter from a previous marriage. And her, you know, riding along with them on this voyage to this island filled with, you know, man-eating dinosaurs, you know, in hopes of maybe them working out their issues, as well as Malcolm's abandonment issues with his girlfriend. Yeah. And on top of that, you have them trying to rescue a baby T-Rex back to its mother. It's all about abandonment. And it's just, even if I felt that there was some sort of theme going on, I can't do it. Every time I try watching it, I end up wanting to do something else.
Also, another thing, you know, about the strange daughter, Kelly, her name is, I think.
Yeah.
She seemed a little bit too, like, adult-like. She's supposed to be a kid, and there's no innocence to her, just like Lex and Timmy.
Well, no, I think that was the point, though. That was totally the point, because me and Malcolm's daughter would be intelligent. That is that is right. The problem is that they never let you forget that. They never give the idea of the relationship between a daughter and a father, like that little moment where you're like, she is a little girl underneath all that. You never get that.
Yeah.
You just you still get the whiny woman who miraculously knows how to do gymnastics and save people. I don't get it.
She seemed more like a wife than a strange daughter. I don't know why. Is it just me? But that's the kind of impression I got. There were no moments of that father-daughter thing, like what you were just saying. That's a good point, because it seemed more like a wife, another wife versus a husband, not a father and daughter relationship.
Something doesn't quite connect there. And even though there are some amusing moments, there are some fun scenes, and I would say one really, you know, good action scene. Outside of that, it really is kind of like one of those exercises where you're like, they didn't really have to make this.
The only thing I liked about it was, you know, the baby dinosaur.
Oh, the baby T-Rex?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That was some awesome effects work right there. I still completely buy that's a real thing, and that Vince Vaughn is a total idiot for walking into the trailer. But
yeah, exactly.
But and also really worth seeing was Pete Postlethwaite playing the game hunter that wants
Roland?
To hunt himself. Yeah,
Roland.
Yeah, but that's Pete Postlethwaite, though. He's always awesome. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, he has a small role in Inception that was freaking great. To have him play Cillian Murphy's dad, that was awesome sauce. But yeah, I mean, in the end, I mean, Jurassic Park versus Lost World. So you would say that? What do you think?
I mean, I also like this one scene. I don't know if it's appropriate to talk about scenes right now, but I would have to say that scene where Sarah gets stuck to the glass. I really like that.
Oh, yeah, the trailer scene where it's hanging off the edge. That's the action scene I was going to mention. That's honestly, to me, the reason to see the film is just the execution of that whole scene. My only problem with the scene is it goes on way too long.
Yeah.
However, that beginning, when it falls over the edge and the gravity is pulling them out towards towards the deep, deep cliffs that are going down towards the ocean, and, you know, Julianne Moore falls and lands on that glass. You don't see the glass. You think she's going to fall through, and she hits the glass.
Yeah.
And now you see the cracks starting to form, the spidering of the cracks. That's brilliant. That is great.
I was scared the whole time because I wasn't sure if she was going to, like, stay alive or not, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how suspenseful it was, but then they were doing a little bit too much, you know.
Yeah.
They were being redundant, and they were just dragging it way too long.
I think maybe that Spielberg got a little bit greedy with that scene, and he wanted to just milk it for all it's worth because he wasn't that interested in the other stuff.
Oh, wow.
That's just a theory. I could be totally wrong. But so, okay, I'm just saying, would you say Jurassic Park, Lost World, and which one would you want to see on a regular night?
On a regular night, I would watch the first one any day.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering if that, because that sounds to be the case here. I think it's unanimous. We're both, you know, very much perfectly cool with the original Jurassic Park, Lost World. You know, would you recommend that at all, or?
I don't know if I could recommend it, but I want to say this. It's always good to watch, you know, watch it just to, you know, have something to compare it with.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know if I would say that it's like the best thing I've ever seen. It's not bad, you know. Even you know, when it's mediocre, Steven Spielberg, you know, somehow pulls it off. But, you know, I would just have to say, if you want to just have the whole experience, it's better to watch all of it.
All right, in that which case, that'll be perfect for you to finally catch 3, and I'd be excited to see your reaction to that, because I already know my feelings on that.
But I mean, my thing is this: how would you know the good when you don't see the bad, you know? You won't be able to appreciate the good when you don't know what bad is.
That's true. However, we can at least give people an educated idea as to, you know, what to expect. So that way they don't feel like they spent money in vain.
Exactly.
But then again, these are like DVDs you can rent on Netflix for dirt cheap, or you can buy at the store for really cheap nowadays. DVDs are pretty much, you know, they're piddly now, so it's not really a big deal. However, you know, if you want your bang for your buck, I'd still say watch the original. And if you're going to, you know, honestly, that this 3-pack, even now, even though you haven't seen part 3, I still say it's totally worth it. Even if you're really just paying for the first movie and you get the second and third movie for free, it's still worth it. It still totally is. It's still a really, really fun movie all around. You know, it kind of stands in the shadow of Jaws. I personally prefer Jaws much more and Duel much more. But
Especially if you're a Steven Spielberg fan, you know, watch all of his movies.
Oh, man, it's hard. Man, how many has it been now? It's nuts.
There's, like, so many. There's so many. But even when he's at his weakest, he still somehow pulls it off, like what I just said.
Yeah, even when he's an apologizing little ugh. But even then, he's perfectly cool. At least, could be worse.
Yeah.
Could be Lucas.
I was just going to say that. You read my mind.
Yeah, so with that said, you know, and Crystal Skull notwithstanding, we still love you, Steven. And with that, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up this time. We will definitely come back with another competition and something a little bit more rough, actually, something more diametric, not in a series, but we're going to put two very, very popular titles up against each other and see how they come out through the eyes of two different generations of fandom. That's going to be me, and it's going to be Jenny. So on behalf of Adventures on Infinite Island, this is Mike, and this is Jenny.
Hello.
Bye. Alrighty, and we're going to go ahead and sign off for now. And also,
By the way, one more thing. Sorry, I'm all getting nervous now because I'm so excited about this something versus something thing that we're going to be doing in the future. It's kind of like playing a video game, you know. If you're to play Street Fighter, it's like, you know, Chun-Li versus Ken or something, you know, that kind of deal. So look forward to it,
awesome.
Definitely.
Okay, so you can find us online at, let's see here, Adventures on Infant Island It's going. You know what? I feel like such a ditz right now. I went completely blank. Let me just go ahead and give you the URL as to where we can be found. You can find all of our episodes here at infantislandpodcast.blogspot.com. You can also find my writings on film and anime and pop culture at wanderingkaiju.blogspot.com. You can also find me on Twitter, on twitter.com/wintermuted. With Jenny, you can find her at, is it twitter.com/magicwandgirl10? Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
Magic Wand Girl 10. And we will pop up much more often after this. Once again, this is Mike.
And this was Jenny.
And have yourself a great night, guys. See you next time at Adventures on Infinite Island. Take care.
Thank you for listening. Goodbye.